Oh, I don't know about you, Shadi, but like, I feel like all we talk about on this podcast is Twitter and its ills. And I I always find, especially lately, I'm finding that tweeting is, when I do it, it's taking the place of actual productive writing. Like after I do a whole sort of slew of tweets, I don't want to write anymore. And that's another reason for me to hate it. I'm fine. Do you find that?
I try to do is if I do a long tweet thread, and it's like substantive and I put some time into it, I try to sometimes convert that into a longer article. So that's what I did with my ISIS piece from a couple of weeks ago. It started off as a thread that my editor at The Atlantic saw. And then he emailed me. He's like, Shadi, do you want to expand on the idea?
Mm. Do you ever do that with talks also? Like you write up notes for talks and then you make an essay out of that? Or do you make talks out of essays that you've already written?
No, I make talks out of tweet threads.
Perfect, perfect. Oh man. Yeah, anyway, I don't know. I feel like I've been on Twitter a lot this week and I feel spent. You know, I was telling you I didn't want to even record tonight because I was going to write, but then I got on Twitter before our podcast in preparation for doing it. And then, you know, almost as I'm resigned not to write anything right now. So
yeah, but your voice needs to be on Twitter about all this stuff that's going on. Like people need to know what Demir is thinking.
Wow, that's very kind. But
no, but, because in some sense you've helped shape the debate. So people don't know what to make of the whole Macron interview in The Economist. And here you are coming and you're saying, you know, you're telling people how to think about it, right?
I'm racked with all sorts of doubts about it because I you know, as I've gone through a lot of these versions of this argument, I'm not exactly sure what they're thinking in the Élysée. But anyway, let's maybe just take a jump back. I mean, I guess we'll link to the Macron interview in the show notes, so people should go and read it. But it's interesting, you know. I've been sort of following what Macron's been doing for the last couple of months, but a little passively. And it sort of dawned on me recently. Actually, a German friend prompted me to go and look more closely at what he has been saying. And I started following this before the Economist speech. He gave a long interview. A long speech to his foreign service, which outlined most of the stuff which was in the Economist interview ahead of time. So it's not really new at all. It's all been there. It's just it sort of captured people's imagination all of a sudden right now. I think it's really significant in a lot of ways that hasn't been grasped, but I'm not sure that I've grasped it correctly either yet. So I guess maybe that's why I'm trying it out on Twitter before I actually commit to something.
Yeah, and I guess you're trying it out on this podcast too.
I guess so. I don't know. So, I mean, you're not a Europeanist, and I was encouraging you to read it. What struck you about it, or if anything? And then we can sort of
So our listeners should know that I only read the Macron interview earlier today under duress from Demir because he's like, "Hey, we're recording tonight." And then, so I had to kind of read it. And so it's interesting from my standpoint because I had just been following the commentary around it. And it's always intriguing when you haven't read something, but you only read the commentary around it. So you're already kind of forming an opinion based on what other people are saying. And I was somewhat surprised because what I read was quite different than what other people said they were reading. And so there was a kind of gap where people were freaking out. Emmanuel Macron is saying these outrageous things or controversial things. And how could he possibly say this publicly about NATO enlargement or Article 5 or Europe hunkering down, all these things. But I read the transcript and it didn't seem particularly provocative to me. It was more interesting than what you usually hear from world leaders. And Macron, to his credit or perhaps to his discredit, tends to be more open about his views. And we know this about him, so it's not a surprise. But there was nothing that I read in the transcript, and it's a long interview. It took me like a half an hour to get through or something. But there was nothing that really stood out to me as like, oh my God, he actually said that. But we should note, you know, you know, one of our mutual Bosnian friends, Riada Akyol, wrote a good piece about this, and she kind of brought it to my attention that there was at least one little small part that Macron sort of said in passing about Bosnia that was quite problematic. But if we're focusing on the EU stuff, the enlargement, what he says about Germany, what he says about Trump and NATO, there's nothing there that should really strike us. And I think Demir, I think you had a good point about this, that it wasn't so much the substance of what he said, it's the fact that he said things that we all sort of know and talk about, and he kind of said it out loud and he put it out there in a way that's unusual for a world leader or for a president, right?
Let's just aside. I mean, I agree. I think everyone should read Riada's piece, and we should link to it also in the show notes, because it talks about the question of Islamophobia. And another person I've never actually met, but corresponded with, and we published him a few times in the magazine, Bruno Macias, wrote an article making the case that you know, the main underlying theme that's tying together all of Macron's stuff is a special animus against Muslims. And we can and maybe should talk about that a little later. But, you know, what I'd like to hear from you, and maybe we can kick this around a little bit, it's that here in this era of Trump, Brexit, Trump, Erdogan to a certain extent, Orban, all these guys are lumped together to a certain extent as being authoritarians, Brexit's not a person, but there's a certain kind of authoritarian impulse here that is expressing itself, and that this is our enemy, however you put our, but us the right-thinking liberals of the West, and this is what we ought to oppose. I know, you know, you feel that like the us versus authoritarian frame is pretty good. What I really find the most interesting about Macron and his speech here is that it's actually very compatible with Putin's vision of the world. He comes back to this question of sovereignty a lot. It's actually very compatible with Orbanism in a lot of ways. Now, again, it's not compatible if we define authoritarianism as clamping down on free media basically squelching debate internally. That's not what Macron's about. Macron is actually, in fact, a liberal. But a lot of what he set out, I would argue, is it doesn't fall neatly into these two things. And for me, you know, the part that's always I found difficult to swallow when people talk about Trumpism here, and not Trumpism in the face of Trump and how he comes out, not the corruption, not the sleaziness, not the incompetence, not the racism, though, again, racism and anti-immigration gets into sort of hairy points. But it seems to elide all sorts of things into this bucket of authoritarianism, i.e. not us, i.e. the other. And, you know, at least on foreign policy, again, it's not my foreign policy, but I've been more than exposed to it and talked to plenty of people in Washington, D.C. way before Trump existed that were very much on board with a lot of the sort of foreign policy precepts that he is throwing out there. And it's been fascinating to see Macron do it right now, because I haven't yet seen this idea that Macron's been gotten to by the Russians, which has been the easy slur that everyone can just sort of throw at people who don't conform to this kind of, again, I don't have really a word for it, but liberal maximalism, call it like post-1989 triumphalism. it's sort of what I was writing about in my review of Bob Kagan's book. And, you know, that I thought that while that book was really interesting, the danger of what he was doing was setting up this category of authoritarians, anti-liberals that stand in opposition for all that is good and pure. What's interesting about Macron to me, I think this is the crux of it, is that he presents all the sort of bigger picture trappings of what people find abhorrent. You know, in the European context, a stop on enlargement means basically a kind of immigration restrictionism. I mean, it maps very neatly on that. An obsession of sovereignty and an obsession with borders and citizenship, that is belonging to and therefore excluding others. And yet he does it. First, he's not, you know, at least as far as we know, there's no sign that he's owned by the Russians on this, that he's, you know, has any financial debts to it. And most interestingly, and I think most confoundingly for that category, he does it in the service of liberalism. He says that if we're to preserve, you know, what we've managed to build here in Europe, the liberal construct that we've managed to build, you know, since 1945, even more so since 1989, we have to stop expanding. We cannot afford to indulge in this fantasy of the good spreading and the universal. He talks about universals still being valid, but it's interesting. He couches it as universals only being valid within the context. That is to say, we believe in the set of universals, but in the pragmatic world, we live in a fallen time and it ain't spreading and we can't be thinking we're spreading it. To think in messianic terms is death for Europe and death for all the values we stand for. And that's why, you know, this moment for me is so fascinating because while I was tweeting, I think the policy implications of a lot of what he's laid out, like rapprochement with Russia, like, you know, even forestalling EU enlargement to a certain extent, especially in the Western Balkans, for very parochial, narrow terms, I think it can have really destructive outcomes. However, on the merits, I think he's not crazy at all to say that this liberal messianism has caused a reaction among voters, and it needs to be, if not certainly, he would never say it needs to be rejected, but it needs to be curbed in order for it to even continue flourishing.
Yeah, so I think you're right. So I'm more messianic myself. That said, if I was the French president, I can see the logic of Macron's approach. He is in a difficult situation. He has pressures domestically. He has pressures from his far right flank coming from Marine Le Pen and the National Rally, previously the National Front. France does have issues with Muslim integration. But I think also Macron is correctly looking at the U.S. role, and he's saying, we can't count on the U.S. anymore as Europeans, as French. So we have to think beyond American protection or the American umbrella. And that restricts the kind of action that someone like Macron has. So we as Americans, in some sense, have the luxury to think in messianic terms. And I actually think that can be a good thing, at least from my perspective, as someone who's more open to a proactive, pro-democracy approach in the world and in the Middle East and so on. But if you're coming at it from a French perspective, you're going to have a different set of priorities. And I think that's what Macron is basically conveying and what he has been conveying for some time. But you get at this kind of paradox, which is this idea of closing down or hunkering down, but doing so in the name of liberalism. And that's not too dissimilar from what you hear from certain figures on the far right. Not to say, obviously, Macron is not, he's a centrist, but it's interesting to see a kind of overlapping of language. And you know, so I was, and maybe one day we'll talk about this on the podcast, but so I, when I was in Germany last month, and one of the things I was there doing was interviewing leaders of the AfD, the right-wing populist party in Germany. And it's interesting that they would couch their opposition to immigration and their opposition, in some sense, to Muslims or Islam more broadly, in the language of defending liberalism, that for liberalism to survive, there has to be a kind of closing. So I see echoes of that. And honestly, I hadn't really thought of it in those terms until you mentioned it right now. So I'm hearing you talk right now, and I'm like, I have heard this before.
You know, as I tweeted, though, I mean, we actually heard it before a while ago when the Dutch, you know, firebrand politician Pim Fortuyn, the gay anti-Muslim or anti-immigration politician that in many ways I think prefigures all of this, right? So yeah, we have heard it before. I mean, you know what I was tweeting about the thing. I remember even when Pim Fortuyn, when he was killed, I wasn't aware of him before he was killed. I remember then reading up about him back in the day and saying, God, that's kind of a scary paradox that he's actually pointing at, right? Because it's quite frankly a lack of faith in assimilation that is driving that. Moreover, and I think this is somewhat difficult for Americans to understand, is that assimilation doesn't work as well in Europe as it does here. Now, again, that's a very complicated and hairy issue that I'm not willing to, you know, make categorical statements on, because country by country, situation by situation, and it's a difficult thing. But at least as a political statement, it is scarily potent, because it completely, to my ear, transcends the narrow parochial racist and sounds perfectly plausible. Again, you know, when Macron did his blocking, like a week later, I was in North Macedonia, and actually were meeting with government people, and just sort of just as it had happened. And, you know, one of the questions that sort of came up at one of the dinners I was at was like, how could Macron do this? He's supposed to be one of the good guys, one of the liberals, you know? I spoke up and I said, well, you know, I mean, let's not forget that Macron is a liberal populist, or at least that's how, you know, it's a good way to think about him, is to remember that he's a populist, that he came in and overturned the entire existing political system in France, that he's a bit of a megalomaniacal guy who named his party, the initials of his party after his own, En Marche, Emmanuel Macron. You knew that, didn't you? Really?
I mean, I know that his movement was called En Marche,
but
I
didn't know. EM.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean, wait, are you suggesting that?
I'm pretty sure that's why. But anyway, whether that's true or not, maybe I'm just, but I've heard that said. Look, the fact of the matter is that, you know, people also lump populists in with authoritarians. I think that's a mistake. Populism is both sort of, you know, just a rhetorical move. But moreover, populists that come to power on the back of this rhetorical move come to power because a certain set of, you know, a certain kind of governance failure gives them an opening to basically point to this failure and come in. Now, this can be just normal democratic process, but it can also be, you know, with these sort of more demagogic overtones. All I'm getting at is that, you know, Macron here is at least rhetorically very much playing to populist script, which is to say that there is a feeling that there's been an elite failure on the question of immigration and assimilation in Europe. That ties in beautifully also to this fact that, and this is why I quibble with the idea that this is merely Islamophobia, because it ties to a deeper feeling that enlargement in Europe has gone too fast and isn't working. Again, you know, one can cite all sorts of statistics, and one can cite to the fact that the European Union, despite all its headaches, still gets things done. But it's also the fact that there's been a kind of that these populists are tapping into a kind of feeling of elite failure that, you know, for all sorts of reasons. So that to me is the thing about Pim Fortuyn, populism, Macron, and all of this. That's why I don't think it's smart even to think of it as merely a far right phenomenon. I think the fact that you know, you say that it's a far right thing ends up, it becomes far too easy to dismiss. And I think we underestimate how alluring and plausible the argument is.
Yeah. So, okay. There's a lot there. So one thing is that we associate some of these ideas with the far right, but you're exactly right that it goes well beyond that. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, quote unquote, far right parties are doing relatively well in many European countries, because what they're saying doesn't just appeal to a fringe. It has broad purchase throughout society. So when people talk about Muslims being difficult to integrate and how Islam isn't a natural fit for secular Western European societies, you can be a leftist or a centrist or a liberal or whatever. You hear that, and you might not like the kind of rhetoric that the far right uses, but you sort of think to yourself, well, they might have a point there. And I mean, that's so in that sense, these ideas are not just far right ideas. You're exactly right. And that's important to remember. There is an undercurrent of discomfort with Islam in Western European societies that is fairly broad based. And you even see some of that on the European liberal left, where because they're secular, they see the growing share of the Muslim population as a potential threat to these secular ideals. And especially in France, that's something that you see across the board, because there is a deep secular consensus, and not just a secular consensus, but an aggressively secular consensus. That said, I'm not sure I would call I don't know how I feel about Macron being characterized as a populist, in the sense that he is a creature of the establishment. He is like a meritocratic creation, if you will. So it's not as if he like came out of nowhere. I mean, he was previously the minister of whatever they call whatever it in France, yeah. Whatever, finance, yeah. Or economy or whatever. And was someone who was close to the previous president, François Hollande. And also, like, Macron's got this, like, really, he's got, like, this irritatingly elite, like, he's one of those, like, really smart guys who's kind of
megalomaniacal, like Obama, yeah?
Okay, when I was reading the Economist interview, I'm like, he totally reminds me of Obama.
Yeah, yeah.
This sort of like sense of being in love with your own intellect, and that even though you're a president of a powerful country, you're almost taking a step back and playing the role of the political analyst who's like looking from afar and saying, here's what's happening in the world, let me tell you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, like you have some role in this. You're not just a kind of innocent bystander. It's obviously worse in the case of Obama because he was a leader of the most powerful country in the world. People can debate how powerful France is, but there is this sense of this detached cerebral analysis that is, you know, I don't know. Anyway.
Well, just, you know, on the question of Islam, the only thing I'd add to this, and this is why, again, I don't want to in any way say that there isn't a even prominent thread in this about that deals exclusively with Islam. But on the broader European and integration question, again, it's a cliche, but just think of the Polish plumber and his role in the British psyche. You know, this whole idea that
wait, Demir, who's the Polish plumber?
I don't know. Okay.
Well, wait, is that a thing? No,
it's a thing. Yeah. The Brits were freaking out about Polish plumbers coming to take their jobs. And you know, white Christians, what do you want? And still there was this feeling that these people, other sort of stuff that circulates through European and Euroskeptic, and it's not scurrilous because it's actually based in facts. There were, you know, Polish people coming and taking lower paying jobs in England. And the other one is you know, Romanian healthcare tourists coming from Eastern Europe and then, you know, freeloading on Western European welfare states, collecting checks and then going back. I mean, these are sorts of things that knock around. You know, you don't even have to look for Islam. You look at the question of the Roma, you know, the in the un-PC term, the gypsy populations in all of these Eastern European countries and what the Italians were doing with that, you know, with the slums and clearing that has nothing to do with Islam.
Yeah, but Islam captures the imagination in a way that all the other things you mentioned don't and can't.
That's fine. All I'm saying is that I would subsume all of these as lesser included elements of a certain kind of Euroscepticism.
Yeah.
That's the important thing to me. I'm not saying that, again, I'm not denying that Islamophobia is there. I just think to categorize this as merely bigotry is wrong. It's that there's an opportunity here, a political opportunity for political entrepreneurs because the European project is perceived not by majorities. You look at Eurobarometer, it's not by majorities, but by enough of an electoral chunk to make hay of this. And again, if you're sort of balancing through this in interesting ways, you can actually come to power and actually control, if not majorities, but definitely a sizable governing portion of the electorate.
Yeah.
And that to me is what's interesting about this is that, again, coming back to that, what I was saying about the and why people are so repelled by Trump, so horrified by Brexit, so horrified and repelled by Orban and threatened by Erdoganism and Putinism. It's because all of these people are saying, you know, your maximalist dream of 1989 of the world transformed is hollow. And it's interesting to see Macron, not because he's the first one to say it, not because he's the first person to leverage this trope of I'm saying it because I love liberalism, that's why. But he's probably the most highly placed politician to do the I am saving liberalism from its worst excesses thing. And I don't see anyone with an answer to that except people saying, you know, well, this is what the authoritarians say, you know, which to me gets at the exact same problem with this category of authoritarians as evil. I think, you know, I'm not saying that authoritarianism doesn't exist. I'm not saying it's not a problem. But this idea that authoritarianism represents anything more than a certain kind of, I think, institutional rot in weakly institutionalized countries, I think it's a dumb category to set us up against. Yeah. And that's been my argument for a while, which I think is, to me, now becoming clearer as I think through the Macron statement.
Yeah, so I do appreciate that Macron, you know, is the rare leader of a Western country, as far as I can tell, that is actually willing to go out there and challenge the elite consensus of his predecessors and say, hey, we got a lot of things wrong and we're somewhat responsible or perhaps more than somewhat responsible for the mess that that some of the world is in right now. And I think that there is something, I mean, I don't think that he's the most insightful person when he talks about this, but at least he's actually putting out some of these ideas and challenging this consensus, which clearly hasn't worked out all that well. So I do like that. And but then it gets back to this question of are you a president or are you a political analyst? So for example, on the question, just to go back, something you said earlier, I think struck me where I get the sense that Macron is almost saying about Islam or Muslims, he's like, in an ideal world, we would be better at integrating Muslims in Western Europe and in France. And that would be what we would all hope for or what we would all want. But he's almost kind of taking a step back and saying, maybe we just have to face the facts that Europe doesn't have the resources to do integration well. And maybe that's just the way it is. And if you kind of take that premise that there's something inherent about, you know, European nation states that makes it more difficult to integrate immigrants in general, but Muslim immigrants in particular, then you could kind of make a descriptive argument, which I think Macron is pretty much doing, that, hey, I don't like it, but we're not good at this. There is an issue with Islam, you know, and hey, maybe for those reasons, we have to be clear-eyed about the limitations of how much integration we can actually do. And from an American perspective, that's obviously problematic and it makes me uncomfortable. But because I'm American and because we as Americans have resources that Europeans don't and the French don't, that it's hard. There's a real gap here. And the things that we want Europeans to be better at, i.e. integrating Muslims, they just don't, they're just not good at it. So Macron seems to be saying, the world is a certain way. We have to be humble about what our ambitions can be. And he's trying to almost hunker down. He's having a more kind of defensive approach. He's seeing the world in this kind of this somewhat cynical way, or this somewhat less ambitious or idealistic way, and saying, let's protect the gains that we have.
Yeah, no, look, again, I just, only thing I'd say, one, I don't think it's exclusively about Muslims. I'll get back to that again. I think it's that the integration project hasn't worked. I think it's right that you know, what you said earlier, that he's taking blame for, you know, the project such as it is not having really worked out. But again, it's not the resources or the ability. I don't think he's being that essentialist about it. I'd also push back on. It's more like we've made a hash of like building the European Union such as it is. The way it's structured, adding more members at this point, it's dysfunctional as it is. Adding more and more poor countries to the mix will make it more dysfunctional, not less, make it even more difficult to reform it, not less. And as a result, we need to pause. And look, again, it's not that I think he is a talented politician. I don't think he's, and I'd quibble as well. The difference with Obama, I think you're right, is that Obama was more of an analyst. I do think Macron's actually much more instrumental about this. I don't think he gave this interview naively. He's been saying a lot of this stuff, and in fact, he's pursuing a lot of this stuff, and he's being strategic about trying to get his way in Europe. I'm not sure it's going to work. I don't think he's gamed out all of this, or even if he has, I don't know if he thinks it's going to work to the full extent. But again, the argument is not that we can't integrate foreigners. It's that if there's any hope for this thing, whatever it is, this European Union, this sort of like union of European Western states, if there's anything for this liberal dream, if it's going to succeed, it needs to forswear expanding, both indefinitely, both it's, you know, any sort of idea that the European Union is the liberal world order in sort of nascent form that has no hope but to spread to the rest of the world by the time they get the gospel of liberalism. Reject that. And, you know, even if you believe it, it's not going to happen anytime soon, because we've done a crap job up until what we have so far, that it's dysfunctional what we've built so far. So now is the time to stop pretending we can do both. We can still believe in, you know, that any human being has rights and et cetera, but we're not going to convert any more states to this.
It's interesting you say convert.
Yeah, well, I think, because I do think, I personally think that liberalism is a messianic faith. We've talked about this here.
Yeah, sure.
And I it is a question of conversion. I mean, I personally think that a lot of that is madness. You know, I to me, that's one of the things why I find myself, you know, I can't help but want the European Union to succeed, because there are clear benefits for peace and prosperity, but I can't help but despair at its most ardent defenders, what they're doing to it. That's why I find myself actually very sympathetic to a lot of this stuff, because I don't believe, I'm not a believer, but I still want the structure to succeed. That's where I find myself on this, you know?
Yeah, so it's interesting that we're talking about an issue that is not really something I work on. So I'm kind of approaching this as an outsider who's kind of listening to other people's conversations. And as someone who doesn't have preformed strong opinions about the EU enlargement, for example, I find myself somewhat amenable to different approaches. So when I hear Macron saying, hey, we got to take a pause and maybe hold off on this enlargement, I'm open to what he's saying. I'm not going to just, you know, say out of hand that this is dangerous or bad or whatever. And that's also like something that can be positive about not having strong opinions about something. Because I'm used to, like, I think so far in the podcast episodes that we've done, I've generally had pretty strongly formed opinions, or at least I've like formed them right before we started recording.
Right, right.
Like on the fly. But you know what? I just don't feel passionate about the EU.
Well, so I don't know. Let me then just try and get you passionate through a side door, maybe. You were saying earlier on about, you know, let me try and recreate it. Something along the lines is, as an American and sort of the universal appeal and universal ambitions for these values and ideas, and how as an American we have the luxury of doing that, whereas, you know, smaller countries maybe don't. Do you think, therefore, if you are so passionate about, you know, this sort of, you know, spreading this ideal, this gospel, if you will, should the United States be committed to ensuring that the gospel succeeds in Europe? Should we be committing materiel? Should we be committing military resources to defend it? Should we be guiding it and shaping it and doing everything we can for it to succeed? Is this, you know, again, to flip what I was saying, or to flip what Macron's sort of implying, that this is the liberal world order, if not in chrysalis form, but in like pupa stage, right? And like we need to nourish it. If it's going to work anywhere, it needs to work in Europe. And therefore, the United States, you know, has a values-based interest in focusing at least a sizable chunk of its energies and making sure that it works.
So look, if I was the American president,
right, or advising one,
President Hamid.
let's say President Hamid, or let's say National Security Advisor Hamid. Maybe that's more likely.
Yeah, President Hamid, the first Muslim president. Oh, sorry, never mind. Yeah. The second Muslim president after Obama.
Right, right.
I hope there are listeners will know that this is like a kind. Yeah,
yeah.
I don't literally mean that Obama was Muslim.
Of course, of course.
So if I was in, you know, what some, you know, policy advising position where I could kind of like weigh in on this stuff, I would listen to something that Macron says, and I would be pretty concerned, because I don't necessarily love the idea of France going its own way.
Mm-hmm.
I Why? Want there to be top-level coordination on fundamental concerns with our European allies. But that's my ideal. And I would hope that... Because essentially what Macron is responding to is a sense of American absence. So presumably if there was a sense of American presence, there could be a different kind of French or European approach. They need to see that there is a more involved American vision that includes Europe and has a vision for Europe, right? And I think that's important, because for me, it's not so much liberalism. I mean, as we've talked about before, I'm not some like liberal messianist, but I am to some extent messianic in quotation marks when it comes to democracies working together, because we as democracies do have shared values that go beyond liberalism, or perhaps don't go as far as liberalism, but still there is a shared element there, because democracies, to me, even if they're not necessarily fully liberal democracies, do have starting assumptions that non-democracies do not share, i.e. Russia, China, and so on. And that's why I like some of these ideas around like a D10, or a League of Democracies. And there's an interesting paper. I haven't finished it yet, but it's It's co-authored by Ash Jane and Matthew Kronig. And one of the things that they propose is this idea of, it's not enough to have the UN or the G whatever. You need to also have a collection of democracies that coordinate very closely. And they suggest a D10, i.e. 10 democracies that coordinate very closely together and actually take the idea that they're democracies quite seriously, that that's not an accident, that to be powerful democracies also has some kind of implication for you, for how you conduct foreign policy, and that how you organize yourself domestically matters for how you organize yourself in foreign policy terms. So I'm really interested in those kinds of ideas. So if there was a democratic president, Democratic Party president, in 2020 or beyond, I would like to see that person kind of exploring how to emphasize that. But, you know, the problem with some of my ideas, as we've talked about before, there is the ideal of what I would want when I think about, like my dream policy, but I also, then there's the reality of the limitations of what we're actually dealing with. So I'm always in this perpetual tension of, hey, this is what I would ideally want, but I also get that some other people are thinking about it in a much more realistic sense of, hey, this isn't likely to happen, so let's hunker down and deal with what we have. And that's always going to be a kind of perpetual tension.
It's just interesting, you know, that I it's on my list to read that that paper you were saying. I didn't know that that's the thrust of it, because I was just looking.
It's
up
not the thrust. It's one of the proposals.
I'm just saying, you know, that's one of those ideas with like a serious beard on it. It's been kicking around for like the longest time. I remember this because I remember we published a piece. I was just looking it up in 2007 at the American Interest. It was called "Democracies of the World Unite." It was Ivo Dalder and James Lindsay, and it was at Brookings. It was at your own institution.
Okay. Yeah.
And even then, I recall, and I don't know the extent of the beard, but even then, I remember our editor saying, like, "Yeah, this ain't new either." You know, like it's repackaging this idea again. Maybe that's not fully true. Maybe this was the first sort of fullest expression of that idea. Again, that doesn't mean it's a bad one. It's just it's one that's been kicking around and hasn't.
But look, we haven't done it, so in some sense, it's new. It hasn't actually been done before in a serious way, where you prioritize the idea of internal regime type that is a defining characteristic of countries. We haven't really done that, have we?
No, not on a level. I have plenty of quibbles and that this would work or you know any of it. Look, here's the interesting thing, just to maybe be a little more concrete on it rather than theoretical. What's striking about also, and this is not just Macron, you hear this, you travel in Europe all the time. One of the things that is considered a profound parting of ways on fundamental values is climate. I hear this in Europe all the time. And it's not just Trump. It goes back to the fact that we couldn't pass Kyoto. Guns in this country, I have doubts that we'd ever pass some sort of substantive and binding climate treaty. Overall, I'm also sympathetic to the idea that you know these climate treaties are you know sort of busy work of multilateral institutions and things like that. Consider though that in Europe at this point, it is a mark of deep barbarism of America that America is in fact fundamentally a different, almost you know it's an alongside Trump and how much Trump offends them. There's something deeply offensive to them about the fact that Americans refuse to pass binding climate legislation that binds them in an international framework. A smaller, lesser included case, which no European understands, but of course, you know, and they would cite as being that why we're very different, et cetera, and like a fundamental values thing. But of course, it doesn't rise to the level of international discord because it doesn't fit. But it's guns and the death penalty, two other ones where they feel, you know, Americans are fundamentally different from us. So this is not to say that you couldn't on some high level, you know, democracies, rah-rah, you know, we're all on the same side and against the authoritarians thing, that maybe you could patch something like that together. I just think that it's interesting that even in his stuff, because you're right that Macron's saying, yeah, America's absent, but it's not just that. He says it's absent and, you know, the writing's on the wall for a long time, which is, again, something I've argued as well. You know, it's since 2008, there's been a divergence on a lot of this stuff. I think the hollowing out of the sense of purpose of post-1989 and all of that, that's really broken in 2008. But for Europeans, it's more than that. It's that for all sorts of reasons, for all sorts of structural reasons, this happy talk of the, you know, a unity of values ain't enough. Again, it's not for Germans. The Germans can't admit this because their entire conception is based on transcending what they did in World War II, and therefore, you know, of sort of human transcendence and human improvement. And really, again, they buy into this more than you do. This gospel. But I think these are things that do need to be taken into account, that, you know, it's like what binds us across, I think, is fraying. And it ain't just Trump, you know? I think that's what Macron's latching onto. I think it's broadly felt. And it's an issue, you know?
Yeah, so the more time I spend in Europe, and, you know, for our listeners, I spent a good chunk of the past month in Europe, as it were, in Germany and a little bit in France. And I come out of it finding that my American sensibilities are offended.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me, like, how certain ways of looking at the world are just so deep within me.
Yeah.
So even though, like, I identify as being on the left, mm-hmm. I find the focus on the state and the centrality of the state in Germany and France to be very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
In part because I think it makes integration difficult. Mm. You know, once you put the state at the center of these things, but anyway, that's a whole debate for another time.
That's a really interesting thing.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's really good though. That's really good. Yeah, so. Go on, no, tell me more about that. I hadn't thought of that. Like the sort of statefulness makes it impossible to integrate. I mean, that must have been observed before, but I've never actually heard it. That's really good.
So there isn't actually a lot on that. People kind of touch on it here and there, but it is something that I think we have to develop a little bit more, and I want to kind of see what I can write on some of this. But it's actually, I feel like it's going to be like a whole tangent, but I'll just say very briefly,
and then we're wrapping up. We're coming up on an hour.
No,
here.
I don't want this to end.
Well, then don't say very briefly. Then run with the tangent.
Wow. Oh my god, it's like 7:45 already.
Yeah, that's right. We've been going for 50 minutes.
This is crazy to me because this feels to me like we've been talking for 10 minutes. Our listeners might disagree. Yeah. They're gonna be like, oh my god, when is this going to end?
If they're still there, if they're still listening. Anyway, I mean, give us a taste on this. That's fascinating. So it's the sort of statist approach. That, I mean, again, Germany's different from France. France is very statist on these sorts of things. But I mean, it's fascinating, right? Because the French, in so many ways, also at least superficially, are closest to Americans in their attachment, explicit attachment to Enlightenment values, and you know, they define themselves in terms of values more so than any other European country close to America, you know?
Yeah.
So it's very different.
So there's a couple of things. I mean, one is that dependency on the state is, in my view, not good for Muslim minorities. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Muslim immigrants in the U.S. context, that there wasn't that same context of the state being central, I think actually worked pretty well for like my parents and for others who were trying to, like, my parents never talk about the American state. Hmm. I've honestly even never heard that phrase used. I never even really use the phrase of, like, we don't even think about our government in terms of a state that is really present in our lives.
Yeah.
But what we do think about more is a market and a kind of free marketplace to kind of use some of these, you know, perhaps somewhat banal and cliched terms. So my, you know, my parents have a relationship to American society, to local communities, to the economy writ large. That to them is their interface with America, as it were. They don't actually know much about the American state.
Mm.
They don't know much about the American bureaucracy. And this is not just to make kind of elite claim. I mean, there were times when my parents, like early on after they immigrated, weren't particularly well off. But for them, again, like it wasn't this idea that the state was their salvation or the state would help them integrate, so on and so forth. But what I found that, you know, in Germany, for example, you know, there's a question of who funds the mosques and who provides the imams.
Mm.
Now, from an American perspective, you would just say that some of this would be self-funded, that because we have a philanthropic culture, local communities, to some extent, not everywhere, but at least in some parts of the U.S., pitch in to fund their own local Muslim communities and their own local mosques. That's anathema in Germany because there isn't any, that's not something you do. And there's still a tax write-off for like Catholic institutions and Catholic churches to some, I don't fully understand how it works, but there still is this sense that you can put some money to Christian institutions by way of the state, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And similarly, when you're thinking about the problem of integration, you're thinking about what the state can do to help solve it. So there's a problem, then you automatically think, well, if only the German state would be better, if only they could change their policies and encourage integration. But why is it that the state is the locus of integration? Or why is the responsibility on them as opposed to intermediary institutions,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that a lot of imams and Turkish communities in Germany are coming from Turkey, and sermons are still done largely in Turkish. And even the Ministry of Religious Affairs in Turkey, the Diyanet, is providing some of those imams and providing some of their training. And that, from an American perspective, it's sort of like, how is it, why is Turkey so involved in concerns which, from my perspective, should be the concerns of Germans? But of course, the idea of what does that even mean? So from an American perspective, that makes sense. But from a German perspective, what does it even mean for something to be German as opposed to Turkish?
Mm.
That's a whole debate on its own, right? But because there isn't a local philanthropic community, someone has to fill the gap, and there's really only two options: the Turkish state or the German state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's kind of where part of the debate is. And I think it's just, it's weird to me also that you still have a significant number of German citizens of Turkish origin who are voting in Turkish elections.
Yeah.
And voting in disproportionate numbers for Erdogan.
Yeah.
That's okay. That honestly, like, I don't want to like blame the victim or punch down, as it were, because it's a challenging situation to be in. It's, you know, the Turkish community, initially they were brought in as guest workers, yeah, and the German state or German society didn't do much to help bring them into society, because the presumption was that they were going to go back to Turkey at some point, right?
Right.
So that's been a problem from day one. But like this, so I want to be, like, I don't want to be disrespectful to the very challenging circumstances and the racism and the economic discrimination or what, like there's a whole list of things that we can talk about. That said, it is a problem if German Turks are still voting in large numbers in Turkish elections. I don't think that's appropriate personally.
Mm.
And I wouldn't want to see my American Muslim countrymen, brethren, voting and taking, I would never vote in another country's election. I am loyal to only one country. I think there's something to be said for that. If you want to kind of like vote just because you can, because you still sort of care about like where you immigrated from and all that, fine. But to make it that like you're voting in a Turkish election because you are Turkish in a way that you're not necessarily German, like there is a problem here.
Yeah. You know, I haven't. So have you read the New York Times article about, I'm German, but I'll never fit in. I think it was just something.
Oh,
about
no,
that.
I didn't see that.
Oh, okay. Put it in the show notes. Nothing to discuss there, but it's just, I saw the headline. The other only interesting thing, and maybe this is a good coda, I need to go look it up now because everything you said there is fascinating. But I seem to remember, I don't think it was in the Economist's interview. I think it was in the speech he gave to his Foreign Service officers. He talks about, Macron does, about how it's terrible that the core organizing principle of the European Union has been the organizing metaphor has been one of the market as opposed to, I don't know what, the state. So it's interesting that you're saying that it's that, in fact, that market logic to a certain extent is what ties what ties America together in juxtaposition to Europe, in the sense that you know, perhaps the folly of Macron's project of trying to build a more coherent and functioning Europe is actually to replicate its pathologies on a European scale. And therefore, you know, perhaps it's even more destined to fail, that pluralism that something like the European Union could only ever hope to manage is only manageable through some kind of market metaphor and not through some sort of statist metaphor, which is what comes naturally, certainly to the French, but perhaps to all Europeans.
And yeah, so I'm in this weird position where I'm a critic of marketization and the centrality of the market from a kind of American perspective, even though I'm somewhat heterodox in confusing ways, which we don't have to go into. That said, when I think about what allows for a pluralistic society, I think about a more market-oriented society that once, even if I want the state to be more involved when it comes to our social safety net in the US, but it's also a kind of be careful what you wish for kind of thing.
Mm.
Beware of state involvement, in part because you don't know who's going to win elections. And I don't want to rely on a state that is controlled by some like bad party that starts putting its ideas in. And you know, so... I don't know. I mean, this is probably a conversation, a much longer conversation that we can have. But
yeah, no.
The state is a problem from my perspective. Maybe there's a solution to the problem, but that doesn't mean it's not a problem, you know?
Right.
And I worry that someone like Macron, he sees the state as the answer.
Right.
And I worry about that with his megalomania, that here's someone who, and this is ultimately, I think, where a lot of European politicians, they see problems to be solved.
Sure.
And they see the state as the only natural vehicle to do the solving.
Arguably, a lot of Democrats in this country are heading that direction as well. There's that criticism is that there's been a Europeanization of American politics in that regard, at least on the left.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Problematic.
But anyway. maybe the hypothesis that I would kind of like put out there, and maybe I'm now being sort of encouraged to think about how I can write about this more, is there is an inverse relationship to a strong state and strong pluralism. And I'm trying to think of any case that is an exception to that premise. And I'm not sure if I can think of one. Can you have a deep, rich pluralism with a strong overbearing state?
Well,
there's a trade-off there.
You can't have a properly liberal pluralistic state. You can have empires. You can have empires that function. You can have empires that function over a very diverse population. Whether it's overweening, yeah. I mean, I guess there's a point where, you know, the burdens of sort of control become so much and it snaps. But there's all sorts of ways to sort of think about that. But none of them are democratic, that's for sure.
Yeah.
You know?
And also, like, I at some fundamental level, I don't want the state messing with my shit.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where I feel like the Americanist comes out of me, that I recoil. Like when I see strong states, I want them away from me. Mm. I'm like, don't fuck with me.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if I told you this. I think I actually texted you about this the other week. My mom, I love
doesn't
how my
like
mom
you.
Is like this like regular, like she gets a regular mention on the podcast.
Right.
She texts me when I was in France the other week, and she's like, Shadi, I listened to another episode of Wisdom of Crowds, and you sweared a lot that time.
Yeah, it's true.
And she's like, Shadi, can you please be careful? I don't, you know, she doesn't feel comfortable with this.
Right, I don't either, to be fair. I'm blushing over here behind the microphone.
But I love that my mom has become a devoted listener.
I love that your mom floats above the podcast as like a censor.
my mom is the podcast censor.
Yeah. Well, we should have your mom on at some point. I think that'd be really fun.
Actually, you know what? You joke.
I don't.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
And people should also know that there is literally a couch that is empty because we're in Demir's living room. And we were wondering dreaming of a possibility where that couch could be full of people, a kind of like live audience or people who can kind of heckle us while we talk.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that and or guests. I think we have to develop.
We have to have a guest.
Really, I mean, you know, it's. I think the role of heckling crowd and guest can, I think, be merged very productive, very productively. I think that could be something.
Because it could be fun to just like have people who kind of like snicker when they really disagree. They're like, oh, wait, seriously?
Oh, Shadi,
like
there
Shadi goes again with his messianic democratic bullshit.
Oh, that's me. That's my role in this podcast. All right, Shadi, this was
okay.
fun.
Cool.
Talk to you soon.
Talk to you later. Bye, Demir.